They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Magellan's at the Movies. Come on in, take your coat off, relax by the fire, maybe grab a drink, because you're on M&M time now. Nathan, we've got plenty of film news to get through in our opening section, which is somewhat misleadingly called banter. Let's start with the biggest one by far, that of the Golden Globes nominations. I have looked through these, a lot of stuff that I have not seen yet, but I am planning on seeing. Great showing from The Brutalist, Anora, two very buzzy movies. Also very strong showing from Emilia Perez. Nathan, if I remember correctly, you said that this was your favorite movie ever, and it made La La Land look like an episode of VeggieTales. Is that, do I have that right?
You don't have that right, Elliot, and we're not going to dive too deep into this, because I do believe I'll be mentioning Emilia Perez in a future episode on with our thoughts, our full thoughts on sort of movies in the year of our Lord 2024. So all I'll say right now is I personally would not be nominating it for as many things as it is nominated for, and the differential might be the total number of nominations it currently has.
Ouch. Well, what do you think generally?
I think it's pretty good. I mean, Conclave getting quite a few nominations. I saw Gabriel LaBelle, the actor playing Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night, was nominated, which I was really excited by. I really, really enjoyed Saturday Night quite a bit. I did catch up on more than a few movies over this past weekend. So I did see Wicked and Gladiator 2. I did a Glicked weekend. I really enjoyed Gladiator 2, so everything it gets nominated for, I'm happy about. If you cast your mind back to our Dune Part 2 review, I really loved it. So I'm disappointed to see Denis not get into the Best Director category. I have yet to see Anora or The Brutalist and some of the other movie Nickel Boys, Sing Sing, A Complete Unknown. I think overall, I'm not over the moon with these nominees because I did not really love Wicked. So, and it's also, I'll say this, Wicked, not a movie for me. I am not a big musical theater person. I'm not a huge... Honestly, despite La La Land being one of my favorite movies of all time, I'm not a huge musicals person in general because I feel like the song sections a lot of the times are just pointless, time-wasting asides as opposed to something that's really propelling the plot or serving any sort of narrative or thematic function. So Wicked was not for me. Didn't enjoy it very much. I am very excited to see A Real Pain. It looks like Jesse Eisenberg is going to run the board or get nominated in screenplay, which I think is very, very deserved because I think if anything besides the performances is carrying A Real Pain, it is a really, really fantastic screenplay by Jesse Eisenberg. So some things to be happy about, but on the whole, I'm not overjoyed. But also, I haven't seen, you know, maybe once I see The Brutalist, I'll be Brutalist-pilled and just talk about how great it is that that movie got as many nominations. But I haven't seen it yet, withholding judgment until then.
Yeah, I feel like I can't really render an opinion on this because I just haven't seen most of the movies. I am really excited for The Brutalist. I mean, dang, people talk about this movie like it is really a transcendent experience. So obviously, I'm happy for it to be that. Not 100% sure about Anora. I don't know. Maybe I'll watch it, maybe I won't. But yeah, I've been hearing good things about Nickel Boys and what's it called? September 5th. It's apparently very strong. So yeah, we will see. Moving right along, Lord of the Rings, The War of the Rohirrim, the notly anticipated anime movie from the Lord of the Rings universe, came out to a collective shrug. I second this shrug. Do we have a third from Nathan?
I didn't see it, so I don't know how much more of a shrug I can manage besides that I'm not seeing it.
Well, that is pretty... That is, as far as shrugs go, I mean, that's like your shoulders are above your head at that point, which is quite painful. So yeah, that's a quick and easy one. Finally, something that I really want to talk to you about, Nathan, is undoubtedly the buzziest upcoming film as of a few days ago is now, thanks to its recently released trailer, 28 Years Later. Which had a trailer that was very, very well received. Lots of love for it. Lots of excitement for this movie. I'm also excited. I have not seen any of the 28 Days Later movies yet because they're impossible to find. But I'm assuming that with this announcement, with this movie, someone's going to be like, oh, let's synergize here and put 28 Days Later back onto streaming or something. So yeah, I like Danny Boyle. I think he's a decent director. But Nathan, have you seen this trailer? Are you interested in it at all?
I've seen pieces of the trailer. Much like you, I haven't seen the other 28 time increment later films. I would love to see them. I also like Danny Boyle a fair amount. I think, I believe I've mentioned this movie on the podcast before, but Sunshine, which is a science fiction film him, with Alex Garland. I think that's the other thing that's kind of exciting is Alex Garland is writing it. He's kind of been making a name for himself in directing more than a couple of fairly well-received movies, but he's back in the writer's chair for this movie. So Danny Boyle and Alex Garland. And really, to return to what I was saying before, I really enjoy Sunshine quite a bit. I think it's a really fascinating science fiction movie that's really well made. If you've never seen it, for sure, go and find a way to see it. So, yeah, I always like excuses to go back and watch movies that kind of have a cult, maybe not a cult following, but have a very positive critical reception around them, but not a good enough, you know, not a critical reception like The Godfather, where I'm like, oh, I have to see this in order to talk about movies in general. So I'm always happy to have an excuse to go back and see movies that I might have otherwise not seen. And yeah, I share your hope that this makes 28 Days Later easier to find.
Yeah, well, just to be clear, you don't have... There's no movie that you have to watch in order to talk about movies in general. To say right, otherwise, right. It's very gatekeeping, Nathan. And I don't approve of that.
You're right. I agree. There's no movie you have to see, I suppose.
You know what? The only movie you have to see in order to talk about movies in general is any movie. That's what I'm going to say.
That's very magnanimous of you, Elliot.
All right, well, there you go. There's a little... See, we insulted each other a little bit there, so that's a little bit bantery.
Yeah, great. Good job.
But enough of this nonsense. Let's talk about our film for today. Nathan, this is one of your picks, so I'm going to send it on over to you. This is something that I have no familiarity with. I had never even heard of it before you decided that that's what we were going to watch, so... what's going on? What the heck is happening in this movie, Nathan?
Yeah, so Badlands is the movie we're covering today. If you've heard of the movie, I think it is a fairly well-regarded film. I can't specifically cite if it's on a list that you would have heard of or a part of a collection that you should be aware of, but Badlands is probably most notable for being the first film, the feature film debut of Terrence Malick, who has gone on to be one of, I'd say, the most beloved art house directors. He directed The Tree of Life, which is probably, if you know any movie from him, is probably the movie you would have heard of, or maybe, I guess, The New World or Thin Red Line. But Badlands was his first movie, released in 1973. He then released one more movie in, I want to say maybe the 80s, called Days of Heaven, or maybe the late 70s, and then took a very extended hiatus from film before returning in the late 90s with Thin Red Line. He's a director who I've seen almost every single one of his movies, except for his most recent one. And I really wanted to revisit this movie because I remembered it very fondly, but I had not seen any other Terrence Malick movies at the time that I watched this one. So I wanted to revisit it, and this podcast only exists for me to revisit movies that I want to see if my thoughts have changed on them. So I wanted to revisit it, and yeah, that's the deal. It follows, the plot is loosely based on a true story of a man and a younger woman who went on a very violent murder spree across the American Northwest. I say loosely based on because it's only based on the idea of that happening. I don't think there's anything beyond that, anything biographical happening in this movie that connects to what happened in real life. But it follows Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek as two kind of classic American lovers who start killing people in order to save their love, so to speak, and then have to continue killing people to continue saving their love. It's a very 70s movie. I'm not going to go too deep into this because I'm sure we'll talk about it in the actual episode. But yeah, that's the plot. That's why you might have heard of it. That's why I had heard of it, is the director Terrence Malick. Yeah, I'm going to flip it over to Elliot for his first thoughts, because you don't have any history with this movie, so you don't need to give a big spiel like I just did.
Yeah, no, the first time I watched this movie was about 8 hours ago.
Nice.
When I watched it this morning.
Good job.
So this is my first Terrence Malick movie, first Terrence Malick movie I've ever seen.
Nice.
I've always wanted to get into his movies, or I've wanted to see what he's all about. I'm just gonna come right out and say it. I am very interested to hear why you like this movie so much. Not because I don't like it. I did like it. I enjoyed it. I thought it was entertaining, very well shot, really interesting soundtrack, fantastic performances across the board. But I think that I came out of the movie, or I got up off the couch and turned the TV off, thinking, there's a movie that really can't get out of its own way. That there were a lot of decisions the movie made, particularly as they relate to the woman whose name has just completely vacated my brain.
Holly?
Holly, yes. Particularly as it relates to her, that just felt like such unforced errors. And I'll get more into that as we go on. But yeah, a lot of stuff to like here, definitely. And some moments that genuinely had me, like, riveted. Absolutely riveted, glued to the TV. But overall, I think that this movie is a movie that's frustrating more than anything else. Because I can see something, like, truly once-in-a-lifetime brilliant at its core, but there's just some things that it does that I'm like, this is not the way to do this. This is getting in the way, that ultimately dragged the movie down a bit on the whole.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed it for the most part, because I always like it more when we don't have to argue and bicker.
That's what the people come for.
But yeah, I think maybe we could start with I guess if I'm going to do first thoughts, I think I enjoyed this movie more than I did the first time, and I think, for a lot of the same reasons that you said when you were describing the positive qualities of this movie. I would also agree, I don't think it's a perfect movie. I think the story of Terrence Malick movies is kind of him getting in his own way, but I do think this is one of the strongest showings because it has the least amount of, like, people standing in a wheat field while super quiet narration plays as they talk about, like, God or something, which is the worst type of Terrence Malick movie. But anyway, I think I want to start on just kind of the tone and vibe of the movie, because I think what really struck me rewatching it was how little of the plot I remembered and how much of the emotions the movie left me with I remembered instead. And I think this is kind of indicative of Terrence Malick movies in general. The number one thing that I think his movies are evoking and are typically characterized as is dreamlike. That his movies feel like you're watching something that is not entirely real, and that he uses a couple of different, I think, techniques. Most notably, he uses a ton of narration. This easily has the least amount of narration of any of his movies, and it still has quite a bit of narration. But I think it is so, so effective, especially when paired with the story that he's depicting here of two deeply, deeply apathetic individuals who seem to care just as much about finding a toaster in the basement as they do about shooting people. That is to say, they don't really care about either of those things very much. And so I think this dreamlike atmosphere that he creates in this film it goes so far into making this movie sit with you, because while you're watching these horrible things happen and these people do, you know, terrible acts, the movie is constantly putting you in this similar state of like, wow, does this matter? Like, you have to do so much effort in order to care about what's happening on screen, which for me at least makes me very invested in the movie and really emotionally engaged with the movie because I have to. And I think, yeah, I think that's the biggest thing that really keeps me invested in this movie, is I think the cinematography, like you already said, is so, so incredible. It is so gorgeous. And I think the cinematography and the score do so much to create this dreamlike sort of atmosphere in this film.
Well, learning that narration is a trademark of Terrence Malick is terrible, terrible news for me, because I actually thought that the narration was one of the worst parts of this entire movie. It never got to the point where I was like, will you please just shut up? But there were definitely times where I was like, oh, come on. Did we really have to hear about that instead of getting to see it? And this is actually like the main problem I have with the movie, is that there is so much telling and not showing. Absolutely, the chief culprit of this has to be the alleged decaying of the relationship between Holly and Martin Sheen. I can't remember his name either.
Kit,
yes. Because I just remember, one of the clearest things I remember from this movie, which isn't a huge statement given that I watched it 8 hours ago, but one of the things that stands out most to me is when they're in the car and Holly is narrating, as she is wont to do at the drop of a hat, and she just says something along the lines of, we were getting distant from each other, or we were falling out of love, or something like that. And I just groaned, because I was like, no, 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 you can't be you can't have major critical developments in characters and character dynamics be done via narration. Like, that is just such a bizarre choice to take. And that's what I mean when I say that the movie is getting in its own way, that the relationship between Holly and Kit is absolutely fascinating, and I wish I had seen more of it. I wish that the movie had leaned into it a little more rather than just kind of skating over these really important evolutions in their relationship. Because what am I supposed to do with that? She just says, we're falling out of love. And so that, to me, says that either it's not important that it's not being seen, or someone just got a little bit lazy, or there were some reshoots and they realized, oh, this is too long, we're gonna have to trim it down. Why about we cut the scene of that shows their relationship deteriorating, and we'll just have Holly talk about it a little bit more, which is not the move that I would have gone with if I had been making this movie.
Let me come in here and play a bit of, I'm not going to say that I think this is 100% true, but let me play Terrence Malick fanboy devil's advocate here for a second. But I believe the reason why Terrence Malick uses so much narration, and especially, I agree, he uses narration instead of showing things a lot. I mean, that's almost all of his most recent movies, besides his most recent movie, which I, again, have not seen, is people doing very little and having a ton of narration. That there's almost no genuine story happening on screen. It's almost all in the audio. And I think, especially in this movie, I believe the reason to be because so much of our development as people does happen in our heads as opposed to in real life. That I think he literally couldn't film, and again, I'm not going to say that I think this is 100% true and your complaints are unwarranted, but I think he couldn't show them falling out of love because there wouldn't be anything to show. Like, the only thing to show would be them doing the usual things and each of them in their head saying, wow, I don't feel what I felt before for this person. And I personally find that to be, you know, maybe I do believe this more than I was letting on earlier. I think that's fairly realistic. And I think especially in terms of Holly and Kit's relationship, which is based on such kind of classic archetypes and motifs of, you know, an older guy falling for a younger girl, and both of them just being kind of clueless and, you know, getting way into deep. I mean, you know, Romeo and Juliet, it has been done time and time again. And I think this is kind of the classic, the sort of ideas that is being played on in this film. And so I don't really have an issue with him telling instead of showing some of these things, because I think with some of them, there's genuinely nothing to show. I really don't think there could be anything that he could show that would communicate Holly doesn't love Kit anymore, outside of Holly just doesn't love Kit anymore. Like, nothing happened. He didn't do something. She's just, you know, she's 15. She's fickle. She, you know, they're in a whirlwind romance. The basis of every whirlwind romance is that eventually what is causing the whirlwind dies down, and you're just left with someone that you don't know very well that you now have no emotional connection to. So I don't have an issue with that. I fully believe everything I said in this section. I think it is because there's nothing to show. So it's not really, you know, show don't tell. He can't. That's what I think.
Well, I definitely agree with you that that is probably not 100% true. If I had to put a number value on it, I maybe would say that that's 0% true.
Oh my god.
That's
goodness.
The ballpark. Because I would have to stridently disagree with the notion that there's no way to show them falling out of love. There are so many ways, so many subtler ways of everything from just like a shot of a disappointed expression to dialogue to comparisons to, you know, like implicit comparisons to how it was before. Like, there's so much that you can do besides just narration. That's a defeatist argument to say that it just can't be done. It can be done. It has been done.
I guess. Well, and I think my other thing is, I don't think that sort of thing detracts very much from my enjoyment of the movie. That in my opinion, and I said this at the beginning, that I think what's most intriguing to me is the types of people that are being depicted here, the types of people that Holly and Kit are, and what they do, and how that reveals just kind of the emptiness in their life. I was reading, this is one of Roger Ebert's great movies, that he has a list of movies that he thinks every movie fan should see. He's a bit of a gatekeeper too, so that's unfortunate. But Badlands is on that list, and he ended his review with a quote that I thought was really great, where he was like, "There, people, it's a depiction of people who are so empty, not even their sin can fill them. Like, not even them doing awful things makes them that interesting. Like, there's still something missing." And I think that's what I find most interesting and compelling about the movie. So the fact that the movie kind of glosses over developments in their relationship, I don't really care, because again, I think their relationship is based on classic motifs that once you establish the motif, I don't think you really need to do a ton more work to, you know, walk me. I don't need to be walked through every step of a, you know, a thing I've seen a million times. I want something new, and that something new is, you know, these characters talking about how little they care about everything.
Well, see, this is kind of the unfortunate thing about talking, is that actually kind of just goes to reinforce or to reaffirm my position in that I'm sitting here thinking that is like the quintessential unforced error, that if it's not a big deal and it's not important and it doesn't even matter that much to the ultimate movie, then why is it even here? Why are you even talking about it at all? Because those kinds of things, to me, in movies, like, that's distracting, and that's an unforced error, that it would be so much better if it just didn't happen at all, if they just forgot about it. So yeah, I'm gonna move on before Nathan can come back and pretend I won. It's fine. Actually, I just don't have anything more to say, and I feel like we're moving towards talking about the characters.
Yeah.
So I just want to say that I totally agree with you in terms of the apathy and the emptiness of these characters, or this character as it relates to Kit, because I think Kit is fascinating. Martin Sheen does a great job. He is absolutely the best part of this movie. He is carrying this movie on his wiry little shoulders, because Holly is just a blank space. She's just a black hole in this movie. The whole dream comparison is very useful here, because she feels, her entire character to me feels like waking up and knowing that you had a dream, but being unable to remember anything about it. That I know Holly was in this movie, and she did a lot of talking, and she was in a lot of shots, but dang if I can remember a single thing that she did, said, or was present for, because she is just nothing. Like, I could maybe, if I was in a generous mood, I could be cajoled into thinking, all right, that's probably in line with what Terrence is going for in terms of the emptiness. Like, she's so empty, she basically doesn't exist. But I would just say that you took it a little too far there, Terry, because she absolutely does not exist. And she is by far the biggest, well, her and the whole relationship thing is by far the biggest obstacle between me and giving this movie the kind of glowing all-timer classic review that a lot of people give this movie.
I think this is another example of us reviewing a movie, and just because you're a little harsher on it than me, I end up coming out like I'm just loving the movie, like this is my favorite this isn't even my favorite Terrence Malick movie, let me be clear. But I actually felt on this rewatch that I would agree with everything you say about Martin Sheen. I think Kit is a fascinating character. I think Martin Sheen does an incredible, incredible job. I think so many of the things Kit does are so fascinating to me. Him giving himself up and then making a little like pile of stone, like thinking that he's so important that they're going to want to mark the spot where they caught him, and it, I think is so fascinating, and you know, just the way he acts about everything I think is really interesting. But what I was really surprised by was how much I enjoyed Holly, and I would stridently disagree. We'll keep stridently doing things. I don't think you can have too empty of a character if the point is the character is empty. And I agree, Holly does virtually nothing. And I think that's what's interesting about her. I think, I had completely forgotten that Sissy Spacek played the role of Holly. And I had actually just recently watched the 70s version of Carrie, where Sissy Spacek plays that. And so I was watching this movie like, dang, she does very little in this as opposed to Carrie. But I think it's so interesting how just uninvolved in her own life she is. And I think the narration goes a long way to showing that, like, she's not a blank slate. She's asking questions and she's kind of engaging with things, right? Like, when Kit kills those two people and when they go to Kato's house and he kills Kato and then he kills the other two people who show up, in her narration she says something along the lines of like, he didn't seem like a violent person up to now. And it's like, bro, he shot your father. Like, what do you mean he did seem violent? And so it's clear she's making steps to engage with the world in a way that Kit kind of isn't or doesn't appear to be. But I think it's interesting that all of that, right, doesn't equal any active motion. The only active thing she really does in this movie is at the very end, she chooses to not go with Kit, that she says, no, I'm giving myself up. And even that is less of like a, you know, I can no longer stand by and watch you kill people. It's more of like, I'm kind of bored with this whole, like, this is kind of whatever. And even her final narration, right, she ends up getting married to someone else and she gets off and, like, you know, none of it, as if this entire experience never mattered. And I think that's really interesting, that Kit for sure is very obviously interesting in his apathy and his, you know, kind of pseudo narcissism that he has going on, where he thinks he's so special and meaningful that everything he says should be heard by everyone on Earth. But Holly is a lot more interesting to me in just this, how much people can have going on behind the scenes that you never see play out into the real world. That the whole movie, she's making attempts to engage with her situation and to think about what's happening, and none of that ever comes out in actions, which I think is really interesting and very, I don't know, realistic. I think everyone has more going on than their actions would imply.
Well, that is certainly a very generous, Christ-like way of looking at it.
If you don't know this by now, I'm the most generous reviewer of all time. If I dislike your movie, it must really suck. I'm so willing to bend over backwards for a film.
Sergio Leone, you know you messed up with Once Upon a Time in America.
Yeah, you did mess up.
I'm sympathetic to this idea because I understand that this is a very precarious balance that Terrence the Big T, as I like to call him as of now, is trying to strike, that obviously there is an inherent risk of, in the less is more approach, obviously there is an inherent risk of just doing nothing, which is, I still think, where we end up with, as far as Holly is concerned. But it's not such a big deal that it ruined the movie for me. Well, I mean, it ruined the movie for me in the sense that it is why I will give it the grade that I end up giving it. But it's not so terrible that I'll end up giving it a bad grade. Because again, I definitely can respect that this was a real swing for the fences in terms of the amount of the deftness that you would have to bring as a writer to the table in order to make this work. And so the fact that he makes it work for one of the characters, I think, is by itself a real accomplishment. But in my view, he does not make it work for both. And it just, I would say that you absolutely can go too far when portraying a character as empty, because when they are so empty that they're just a non-entity, I think that's a problem. But yeah, I do think that Kit is fantastic. And my favorite scene in the movie, bar none, is after he's been arrested and he's in the hangar, just like giving out souvenirs to people, his pen and his lighter. And he's so like, it's so obvious what he thinks is happening here, that he thinks that this is a Bonnie and Clyde level moment, cultural moment in America. And people are going to be treasuring these things for years, and they're going to be sold for millions of dollars. And then in one of the areas where I do think the narration works, Holly just saying, oh yeah, and then 6 months later, he was killed in the electric chair. And like, that's it for him. That is really good. That is really, really good stuff right there.
No, I love that scene as well. I think it's so fantastic. Like I said, I think a lot of this movie works on classic Americana sort of imagery. I mean, she compares Kit to James Dean almost like as soon as she meets him. And I don't know if there's many things that are as Americana as James Dean. And yeah, Bonnie and Clyde, and yeah, I just think there's a lot of great moments of the characters trying to create some sort of incredible romantic idea of what they're doing and then failing to really deliver on that. I loved when they're trying to decide which way to flee from something, and Holly's narration says, like, he decided to spin a bottle, like, we're gonna leave it up to fate, which is such a right classically romantic and over dramatic sort of thing to do. He spins the bottle and then he's like, nah, I don't want to go that way, so actually we'll do this other thing. I was like, oh, that's so funny, where they're like, oh, we'll leave it up to fate, it'll be amazing, never mind, that's a bad idea. And even the last thing Kit said, like, when Holly reveals she doesn't want to go with Kit for his final kind of run, he says something, some ridiculous thing about, like, meet in, you know, 10 years at the Grand Canyon or something, as if there's any even remote possibility of that thing happening. And then he is the one who eventually ends up giving him, like, he gives up any chance for that thing to even happen, which I just think that's so well done, and it's so interesting. And I think especially in comparison to the other movies that were getting very popular in the early 70s, which were movies about empty, apathetic characters just kind of wandering through life with no direction or desire to do something. I think this movie is easily one of the strongest because, you know, not only does it have all these great moments, but it furthers that with this dreamlike atmosphere that Terrence Malick creates.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add there. I think that, yeah, like I said, Kit is carrying this movie on his shoulders. I would also say that Kit is probably the least, or maybe I should say Martin Sheen is the person who I would least be likely to say, he looks like James Dean. I understand that they're doing the same haircut and the same denim jacket and stuff, but all of the hairdos and denim in the world can't make their faces look alike.
That's funny.
But I'm glad that Martin Sheen is in this movie because he's killing it. He's doing.
I don't really have a ton else to say here. We've already mentioned the cinematography is so good. I mean, this is something that is universally true, that Terrence Malick movies look obscenely good. If you weren't aware, his second movie, which is called Days of Heaven, took an extraordinarily long amount of time to film because he filmed almost the entire thing during golden hour, which is like the last few, like, 40 minutes of sunshine where as the sun is setting. And so the movie took forever to film because it's exclusively filmed during that brief period where the sunset just looks gorgeous. So the movie looks gorgeous, but it was a pain to make. So yeah, I think the cinematography is amazing. And then the music, I thought too, was really great. And again, not necessarily something I would listen to casually, but something that I think really helps the dreamlike tone. That the music is very ambient, it's very much built on the same sort of sounds recurring for a while, but it does so much to create a tone for a movie, which I think is so huge. So those are kind of my final thoughts. I guess if I had to come up with a negative, I do think the opening of the movie before they've started killing people and going on the run, and even a little bit after that when they're in a camp in the woods, that section can kind of skew a little more I'm just bored, as opposed to it feels dreamlike, which I think is a very thin line to be walking on. But I think the beginning of the movie is a little more boring than I would like it to be, whereas the back half of the movie, I felt I was very, very engaged and very interested in everything that happened.
Okay, then. I agree. The music is very interesting. It's one of those soundtracks that, yeah, really enhances the movie that it's a part of. Not sure what that instrument is. It's one of those xylophone-like instruments, but not a xylophone. But yeah, really adds to the atmosphere. There's not a whole lot else that I can do to describe it. You just have to experience it for yourself. The movie is fantastic to look at. I think that, again, well, maybe not again, for the first time, one of the biggest strengths of this movie is just how pleasurable it is to watch. Like, the shot composition, and this is one of those moments where I really wish I had the terminology to explain on a technical, mechanical level why this movie looks so good. If I knew more about lenses and camera types and all that kind of stuff, the unfortunate fact is that I really don't. So all I can say is that it just looks real purdy to a stupid layman like myself. I also want to say that I found it increasingly funny, Martin Sheen, or Kit's, habit of throwing things away. Like, there is not a piece of detritus or material in this movie that does not go unkicked or untossed by Kit. And I just found it increasingly funny as he's just throwing things away. I have no idea why. He's just, like, kicking stuff around on the street, picking up sticks, and then throwing them away. And absolutely the funniest moment of this is actually in the aftermath of something truly horrific when it is all but guaranteed. I mean, it's implied, but, I mean, it's, like, 100% sure that Kit and Holly, who's 15 years old, remember, have just had sex. And obviously, that's horrific. But it is another example of really this movie's use of apathy in that afterwards, you don't see anything of it, which, thank goodness. But after in the aftermath, Kit and Holly are both just like, they're just completely unmoved. That yeah. Holly asks a few questions of like, is that how it's supposed to go? And Kit's like, I guess. But anyway, Kit suggests that they crush their hands with a stone to mark the day, which is already pretty funny. And then Holly does not want to do this. So Kit's like, oh, okay, I'll just keep this stone then. And then he immediately throws it away and is like, maybe a lighter one. And then he picks up another one and just immediately throws it away. And oh man, that was really funny.
Well, I think it. I agree. That is very funny, and I do think it's fascinating that yeah. Again, the characters care so little about even something as you know big in the sense of you know societally as losing your virginity. The characters are still unmoved. They don't care about this, and that's another example of them suggesting something that's very classically romantic and overdramatic, and then instantly not doing it or ignoring it. And let's crush our hands under a rock. I love that Holly's just like, no, that's ridiculous. And he's like, why? Because it would hurt? Yeah, that's pretty fun. Man.
Let's just keep it to mark the occasion. Maybe a lighter one.
Doesn't care.
He's just constant. I mean, I don't know. It's like there's a aura of repulsion around him that he's just constantly throwing stuff away.
Could be. Let's get to ratings here. I've talked myself up on this one. Maybe this is my favorite Terrence Malick movie. I feel like after hearing your complaints and explaining why they're wrong and dumb, I think I've really come around for all of the reasons I mentioned. I think the tone of the movie is fascinating. I think it is so, so well made. It's so well acted. It's got so many things going for it. It's a little boring in the beginning, and you know that's kind of tough, but I think overall I'm gonna give it an 8.7 out of 10.
All right, well, since I am far less vulnerable to the caprices of tribalism than Nathan is, I'm actually right where I started with this episode. I have not moved at all. I'm gonna give this movie a strong B.
Nice.
A lot of good stuff. A lot of stuff to recommend it. I would recommend you watch it if you haven't. A lot of interesting stuff. Even just from a purely mechanical point of view, it looks great. It's got a great soundtrack, fantastic performances. Definitely enough to keep it a good, well above average movie. It's just the problems that are 100% smart and true that I delineated in this episode of... going too far in terms of emptiness and telling and not showing unforced errors, they cannot be denied. Or they can be denied, but they can only be denied by silly people.
Okay. All right, well, if you have already seen this movie, or if you're watching this and you want a double feature, if you want two doses of 70s apathy and emptiness, have I got the second movie for you? My recommendation is going to be Five Easy Pieces, which is a Jack Nicholson movie following Jack Nicholson as a kind of he's an oil worker at the beginning of the movie, but then, you know, things happen. It turns out that he was a very, very successful piano prodigy from a very, very rich home, and he's kind of self-destructed his own life, and the reason for which is unknown to everyone around us, but it's pretty clear from the outside looking in that it is this, you know, emptiness and complete lack of care for their own life and the things that they're very talented at. That Jack Nicholson's character doesn't care about the woman that he's in a fairly long-term relationship with. He doesn't care about his sister. He doesn't care about his dad. It is This is one of the movies. I'm not a huge Jack Nicholson fan, but there are a couple of moments in this movie where I think Jack Nicholson just absolutely stunned me with how well he could communicate a person having emotions while also trying to stuff those emotions as far down as humanly possible. This was another movie that I watched just because it was on Roger Ebert's great movies list. So it's also beloved by, you know, beloved movie critic Roger Ebert. But I think if you're going to do a double feature of men in the 70s not caring about their own lives and not caring about the lives of the people around them, I think Five Easy Pieces is a fantastic double feature to pair with Badlands.
Okay, then. I have not seen that movie, so I cannot comment. Now, my recommendation is actually about people caring about their lives, but for very different reasons, for the wrong reasons. My recommendation is going to be The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Very clunky title, but even if you know nothing about this movie, there's a chance you may be more familiar with it than you might think if you have played the video game Red Dead Redemption 2. It, quote-unquote, borrows very heavily from this movie, not just in terms of plot, but in terms of some actual camera work, which got Roger Deakins behind the camera on this movie. Can't go wrong with the Deakins.
So true.
But yeah, I chose this movie because I think that Jesse James Robert Ford in this movie is very similar to kind of what you were talking about earlier in terms of Holly becoming infatuated with someone for all the wrong reasons. That Robert Ford, he's just in it for like fame and attention. And so the reason that he sticks with Jesse James way longer than anyone else is because he's just kind of hanging out on the periphery waiting for his moment to come into the spotlight. And then when it does eventually happen and we see the consequences of that, how his obsession with fame and his kind of naive belief that fame will always be what? Kind? It will never devolve into infamy. Is very tragic, and I think a very American tragedy is hidden in this movie, in that, I mean, Americans, they just want to be famous. They want to be known. They want to be on the big stage, and the way that this movie plays around with that in the context of a really interesting, well-done Western is just quite good. So get out there and watch it. And when you see the shot of the train coming out of the darkness, just try not to make your squeal of delight too loud.
That's I believe that's Roger Deakins' favorite shot of his entire filmography. So yeah, that's, I can second that recommendation, and that was a fantastic Elliot description of the film. I 100% agree. I think that movie as a whole is, I'd be really interested to rewatch it, because I think the last 20 minutes are so, so strong, and yet the movie is like almost 3 hours long. So I'd be interested to know. Maybe I'll request it for the podcast sometime. In the meantime, thank you, dear listeners, for listening in to another brand new episode. We really appreciate it. If you have seen Badlands, if you want to share your favorite Terrence Malick movies, if you just want to email us and let us know which one of us you thought was right in our arguments, send us an email. The link is always in the description for the episodes. Be sure to check out the blog.
If you want a personalized rendition of Life is Hard and Full of Disappointments, you can send us an email and I will reply with something tailored, a bespoke telling of that little maxim. But for the rest of us, for the generic type Life is Hard and Full of Disappointments, just remember, Life is Hard and Full of Disappointments.
Oh, that's great, Elliot. But yeah, be sure to check out the blog. There's new reviews posted there somewhat regularly. And yeah, we're going to be back next week with another brand new episode. So we hope to see you then, and we hope you have a great week in between.